Okay, so we this morning we're going to continue with right mindfulness, sammasati, or satipatthana in the suttas. And just to remind you what this is all about, because sometimes it's easy to get a bit lost when you hear so many details and you wonder what is going on here. But it's quite simple. The kind of the result of all this investigation is quite simple and quite straightforward. And the main point I was making yesterday is that sammasati is what lies behind or between right effort and right samadhi. It's that final purification of the mind and the final kind of unification of the mind that drives it into samadhi. That is what it's all about. And then I looked at what kind of mental state is it that is possible, for which it is possible to do sammasati, to do satipatthana. What are the requirements? And the requirements basically just is that you have to be mindful, right? Mindful and clearly comprehending. Clearly comprehending is this idea that you understand where you're heading here, and you understand whether your mind is going in the right direction or not. And where are we heading? We're heading towards purification, right? So you are aware of whether your mind is moving towards being more purified, and you know roughly what you have to do to head in that direction. That is what clear comprehension is all about, sampajanya. And then you have to be mindful. And that mindfulness is established by everything we have done so far on the path. That is how you establish that mindfulness. So because at this point there aren't that many defilements in the mind, you're not drawn so much to the future or to the past. So the mind is quite stable in the present moment. And that is really the kind of mind state that is capable of doing satipatthana practice. So this is really all that we have been discussing so far. And this is what that amounts to, what we have been talking about. But the reason I've been talking in such detail is because this is the Satipatthana Sutta, right? And this is it's good to understand that this is what it leads to. This is what it's all about. The more the details just confirm that this is what Satipatthana practice actually is. Okay, and then there are these four areas, right? Body, feelings, mind, and then mind objects. So now we're going to look at the first of these areas, which is the contemplation of the body. And as I said before, there are different aspects of the body that are being contemplated here. So that's why there is a number of different contemplation that comes under satipatthana practice. And as you will see here, is that I have left out a fair amount of the ordinary contemplation of the body. You can see I have left only the headings. This is just to remind you what's actually in there. And then I put a few dots to show that I had taken that out. And you may wonder, why have I taken those things out? Why aren't we going through everything here? And the reason is, again, because I'm trying to focus on what are the core aspects of satipatthana practice. And how do we know what are the core aspects and what are perhaps not as core? And again, the way to know that is to look at how the Satipatthana Sutta, how it is found in different traditions, in different schools of Buddhism, and then you compare them all, and then you see what they have in common. And what they have in common, you know, the Chinese version, Sanskrit version, Abhidhamma version, and all these things, and what they have in common, that is most likely to be the core aspect of Satipatthana practice. And it's interesting that Satipatthana Sutta is very different in different traditions. And this shows that there has been some growth and some changes happening over the course of history through this particular sutta. And often people are not aware of that, and you need to have this kind of comparative approach to realize that. But this, so here what we're looking at is the core aspects of Satipatthana, and perhaps you will be surprised that the first aspect that you normally, if you read the Satipatthana Sutta, the very first body contemplation, remember these are aspects of the body, the first one is the mindfulness of breathing here. That is the first one. You come to Anapanasati, is right there among body contemplation, because the breath is an aspect of the body here. And so that I have taken out, and you may think, well, why is that taken out? The reason, again, is that it only occurs in some of the versions of this sutta. And the point is that anapanasati, the breath meditation, doesn't really belong entirely in body contemplation, because the breath contemplation actually, the breath meditation actually is part of the whole satipatthana from the very beginning to the very end. You do breath contemplation, fulfills all the four satipatthanas. Breath contemplation contemplation of the body, contemplation of feeling, contemplation of mind, and contemplation of mind objects. All of those four, breath contemplation fulfills all of those. So for that reason, it is having it just under body doesn't really give it full justice for what breath contemplation does. So that is where that one goes out. And that's why we will look separately after finishing the Satipatthana Sutta. We will look at the Anapanasati Sutta separately to look at the breath meditation. Then there is the four postures and what is called the full awareness. This is full awareness, again, is Sampajanya. And these I, again, have taken out because they're found only rarely in the Satipatthana Suttas. They're not a consistent part of these suttas. So these things, especially like full awareness, usually when you look at the gradual training, it is usually found before Satipatthana in the gradual training. So full awareness is almost like the things in your daily life. You are aware of what you're doing. You are clearly comprehending that you're doing things which are kind of aligned with the Dhamma, right? So you're doing Dhamma things and you're not allowing yourself to be too distracted. And then when you do meditation, that's when you come to Satipatthana, Anapanasati and these things. And then we have the aspects which are found and across the board in absolutely all versions of Satipatthana Suttas everywhere. And that is the contemplation of the 31 parts of the body, which you find coming next year. And this is like a core aspect of Satipatthana practice. And then after that one, comes the five element. And then lastly, you have the cemetery or charnel ground contemplations. And these are also quite core. They are found in most versions of the Satipatthana Sutta, but not all. They are also quite important. So the focus is really on the direct contemplation of the physical body. That is the focus of this kaya nupassana, contemplation of the body. Do you have the element contemplation, Ananda, in your version there? Is that part of it? Or
Insight.
Insight. After insight elements, no?
After insight, no.
No, okay, just insight. Okay. I have got a slightly different version from what you have, so just... Okay. Okay, so the 31 parts of the body, this is kind of the core aspect of Satipatthana practice, of the body contemplation. So let's have a quick look and see how this actually, what this looks like in the Satipatthana Sutta. Again, bhikkhus, a bhikkhu reviews this very body up from the soles of the feet, down from the top of the hair, bounded by skin, as full of many kinds of impurities. Thus, in this body there are head hairs, body hairs, nails, teeth, skin, flesh, sinews, bones, bone marrow, kidneys, heart, liver, diaphragm, spleen, lungs, intestines, mesentery, contents of the stomach, should really just be stomach, feces, bile, phlegm, pus, blood, sweat, fat, tears, grease, spittle, snot, oil of the joints, and urine. You really get everything here. Just as though there were a bag with an opening at both ends, full of many sorts of grain, such as hill rice, red rice, beans, peas, millet, and white rice. And a man with good eyes were to open it and review it thus. This is hill rice, this is red rice, these are beans, these are peas, this is millet, this is white rice. So too, a bhikkhu reviews this same body as full of all these different aspects of the body. Right? So this is the contemplation of the body. And this is this particular contemplation in the suttas is often called asubha sanya. Right? And asubha means beautiful, and asubha means non-beautiful. So it's like contemplation of the non-beautiful. It doesn't mean that it's contemplation of kind of the disgusting. That's not really the point. The point is non-beautiful, right? You're not focusing on the beautiful aspects of the body. You're trying to see the body in a more neutral sense. This is what the body is, right? We all know that this is kind of there, but we don't normally think too much about it. Normally we think about the superficial aspects of the body here. When you look at all of these things, you know, they are not, they are kind of just functions of the body, right? This is how the body works. They're all there. And some of these things might be more, slightly more repulsive than others, but still, it is part of the body here. So you recognize this. And the reason, of course, why we are doing this particular contemplation at this stage in the practice is to take away any kind of remaining attachment and desire for the body. It's very deep-rooted, the attachment to the body. It's very, you know, this is my body. If somebody comes and they want this famous simile of the two-handled saw, right, when they cut you apart, usually you get upset, right, if somebody tries to cut you apart with a two-handled saw. You're not too happy about that. People come to cut off your limbs. And of course, that is, in the end, it is because of attachment to the body. Of course, also because it's painful, of course. But it's not very nice when people do that. But ideally, you know, when you go completely beyond attachment to the body, the Buddha says the person who has developed metta, friendliness fully, is a person who does, even when somebody cuts you limb from limb, still you don't actually have any ill will towards that person. It's a very, very high, setting the bar very high for real metta, for what metta ultimately can give you on this path. And this is part of the path to get there, is the idea that you are reducing the attachment and desire for the body. When you see the body in these terms, you don't feel so attached anymore, right? I mean, how attached are you to kind of your liver or your stomach or your intestines or all of these things? It's not really attractive. It's like, okay, whatever. It does its job and that's it. And this is the idea behind this. So we are now moving towards, you know, again, towards samadhi, right? So any attachment to the body, any attachment, any desire that you have left for the body is going to be a hindrance, because the body has to disappear completely from your perception. As long as there is a perception of body, an attachment to body, you will not be able to let go. And if you can't let go, you won't be able to enter the really deep states of samadhi, because that is a complete letting go of the body. The body disappears. There's no access anymore to the body at all. And to be able to have no access to the body, you have to be able to let go. So this is why this is here at this particular stage. So this is like the preliminary practice of Satipatthana, the first one. And remember, this is stage-wise, right? One coming after the other. One of the important aspects here is that you review this very body. Here it says this same body. Another translation would be this very body. Immang eva kaya. Eva is like an intensifier, this very body. And so you're focusing on yourself, right? This is the whole point. It's always focusing on oneself is always the initial thing. Not on other people, but your own body. This is the way you are. We, each one of us is. So you start off with that. So how do we do that? And you can, usually, the idea is just to visualize, to be aware that these things are inside of you. If you have a hard time figuring out what all of these things are and how they kind of, you know, how they are in the body, I must admit, I don't know exactly where all of these things are, but it doesn't matter so much. You have a rough idea, you know, kidneys, liver, and et cetera, et cetera. And the idea is just to be kind of aware of these things inside of you. It's like you have a picture in your mind of yourself, right? And you see these things in a sense. It's just a visualization process, a sensation of these things being inside of you. If you want to have a picture of it to kind of help you focus, that is fine. But it's not really necessary. You have a general idea of what is going on. So this is basically... generally how you do this kind of practice. And again, the purpose is to get rid of some of that last attachment to the body. Having then looked at that, those 31 parts of the body which are in there, then let's have a look at the next label here, the next thing, which is called insight after this. Now, this is kind of the first point here, is that this thing is labeled as insight, right? Now, the idea is to help you so that you can kind of divide the sutta up into nice parts, right? You have the 31 parts of the body, you have the full awareness, you have the elements, and you have the inside section. But remember, these headings are not found in the Pali. These are added by the translator, right? So the question is, when it says insight, you know, is that correct? Should it really be insight in this case? It is obvious that somebody has decided that this means insight, but is that actually what it means? And this is one of the things that I've been saying all the way along, that when we do this practice of purification, two things happen as a consequence of purifying yourself. And those two things are calm and clear seeing, vipassana and samatha. Both have to come together. They emerge as a consequence of the reduction of the defilements. And they always have to emerge together because they are both a result of less defilements in the mind. So to say that this is insight, and it doesn't really fit either with how the sutta is developed, is actually misleading. And this is how, misleading ideas tend to arise when these kind of things get, especially when it's written down, you think, oh, it must be true because it's written down, right? Maybe it's in the Pali, so etc. But once you know the sutta and you have seen the Pali, you know that actually that is not there. So that's the first issue. So sometimes we have to be careful, right? Because these editors and translators, they put things in there which actually wasn't there to begin with. So let us now look at this little standard. This is a standard kind of passage which occurs after each kind of contemplation. You have this particular passage. So for that reason, it's quite important. So we'll spend a little bit of time on this to try to understand what is going on here. So this is this passage. In this way, he abides contemplating an aspect of the body internally. Or he abides contemplating an aspect of the body externally. Or he abides contemplating an aspect of the body both internally and externally. Or else he abides contemplating in the body its nature of arising. Or he abides contemplating in the body its nature of vanishing. Or he abides contemplating in the body its nature of both arising and vanishing. Or else, mindful that there is body, is simply established in him to the extent necessary for bare knowledge and mindfulness. And he abides independent, not clinging to anything in the world. This too is how a bhikkhu abides contemplating an aspect of the body. So that is this standard passage which occurs after every type of contemplation throughout the Satipatthana Sutta. So it is quite important for that reason. And again, it is very interesting to compare that passage in the Pali and compare it with the Chinese version of this, the version in Sanskrit and all the different kind of versions. And again, distill what do they have in common. Now the most common part, which is common to all of the various suttas, is the first aspect here. You do internally, you do externally, you do both internally and externally. That is the most common one, right? The second aspect, which is about the nature of arising, vanishing, and both arising and vanishing, which has more to do with, some people would say that is more to do with vipassana, but again, remember, anything here is both samatha and vipassana. But that is more to do with insight, perhaps, right? You're watching the impermanence of things, etc. Well, that is the least common thing. So that is probably, if anything is not really part of the sutta, it is that second aspect, the nature of arising, vanishing, and arising and vanishing. And the last part occurs in many of the versions. So this is, or else, mindfulness, that there is body, is simply established. That occurs in quite a few. So that is kind of, possibly, it is a core part of Satipatthana practice. But the most important part here is, again, the first part. You abide internally, externally, and internally, and externally. So what does this mean? And if you look at that, it doesn't really have any It is not really about samatha or vipassana, right? It's just the contemplation of the body in one way or another. If we look at the thing we have just been at the contemplation we have just been seeing of the 31 parts of the body, what is that? Is that samatha? Is it vipassana? Is it calm? Is it about clear seeing or insight? What is it? And when you look at that, well, you could maybe, people might think, oh, it must be about vipassana, because it's about seeing the body according to reality, perhaps, right? You're seeing it as it really is, instead of just seeing the superficial beauty or whatever. That is one way of looking at it. But again, it is not called vipassana in the suttas. It's called the asubhasanya, the perception of the non-beautiful. And other people would say, actually, no, it's not about it, it's about samatha, because what this is all about is about abandoning desire for the body. And when you abandon desire, you feel peaceful. So it's a samatha practice, right? So again, the point is that it is neither samatha nor vipassana. It is a practice that leads to both samatha and vipassana when you do it rightly. And this is the beautiful thing about this. When you start to see it in this way, the whole path is an arising of both calm and clear seeing. It takes away this kind of division that we have in the Buddhist world. People say, no, samatha, no, vipassana. And then you kind of argue with each other, which one is most important, right? On these kind of things. But no, I think it is entirely the wrong way of looking at things. If you practice the path rightly, they both arise together all the time. These are two aspects of the same thing arising together. And it takes away some of that. We don't really need to argue so much anymore, because we are all practicing for the same thing, samatha and vipassana, calm and clear seeing. I think that's a very nice way of looking at it. We stop this kind of division within the Buddhist community so much. Perhaps, I mean, there's always going to be division. I think that's just the nature of humans. We like to discuss things, and we're always going to disagree to some extent. That's just life. But still, I think that is quite a useful way of looking at things. So back to this idea of internally, externally, and both internally and externally. Elsewhere in the suttas, this particular paragraph is said to lead to samadhi, right? If you practice in this way, it leads to samadhi. So again, it's this idea that satipatthana leads to samadhi, to samadhi eventually. So this clear comprehension, samatha and vipassana is just building up, right? And eventually when you come to samadhi, that's just another level of samatha and vipassana. Then you go beyond samadhi to yathabhuta anadasana. It's another level of samatha and vipassana. And you keep building this up and up. So contemplating the body internally is your own body, right? Internally means relating to yourself. Ajata is a Pali word. So it's relating to yourself. That's where you start. Just as I was saying before. And then, once you have related it to yourself, then you do it externally. That is the bodies of others. You recognize all bodies are exactly the same. It doesn't matter. So then you go externally. But always grounded in looking at yourself first of all. And finally, you look at both externally and internally and externally. And that is the point where you kind of universalize, right? You recognize everybody is the same. All bodies are the same. There's no distinction anymore. Internally and externally is a universalization of this idea. Bodies are all composed of these 31 parts. And that is when it becomes a kind of deeper insight, when you universalize in this way. So that is the basic practice of this bodily parts. And you can see here, then we have this other aspect which is not so important, it seems, the arising nature of things, the vanishing nature of things, and both the arising and vanishing nature. This arising and vanishing nature really finds its place towards the end of Satipatthana, when we look at the hindrances and the seven bhujangas, because there it is specifically said that you understand how these things come into existence, how they disappear, how they don't arise in the future. Here, it is not as clear how this should be applied in this particular case. And then we have the last one here, or else mindfulness that there is body is simply established in him, to the extent necessary for bare knowledge and mindfulness. And here the expression bare knowledge and mindfulness is jnana matta and patisati matta. Matta means like a measure of a limited amount, not the full understanding, right? This is what it means. So bare here is not, in my opinion, it's not a very good translation. It means that there is established in him, there is body sufficiently for a certain amount, a limited amount, a degree of knowledge and a degree of mindfulness. In other words, you have reached a certain level, but you still have further to go, right? There's some understanding here, but it's not yet the full understanding here. There is body. It's like just a peaceful abiding here. And then you abide independent, says here. Anicitta, not clinging to anything in the world. And this is again this idea that as this practice matures, as you're letting go of attachments and desires, you have a greater ability to just stand back and to see things for what they are, right? You don't think of it in terms of mine. Once you think of it in terms of yours, you start clinging, you start holding on to these things. And then it's very hard to see things according to their nature. The idea here is that you stand back and you just observe. You see these 31 parts, you see the breath, you see whatever, and you have a neutral feeling towards it. There's no clinging to these things. It says here, not clinging to anything in the world. Again, the question is, what does the world mean in this context? And in this context, because we're still dealing with pre-samadhi experiences, it probably means the world of the five senses. You don't cling to anything in that world of the five senses. The world, the physical world of experience. So, this too is how a bhikkhu abides contemplating an aspect of the body. So there you are. So this is the ideal. And you can see it's fairly simple, right? I apologize again if I made it too complicated yesterday, but the idea is just to move towards a greater understanding of what is happening here. So so that is the 31 parts of the body. I have the little passage on the five elements here as well in my version of this sutta. I might go through that as well, because the element meditation is also quite interesting here, and some of you may find that useful as well. So let's have a very quick look at the elements before we move on to the contemplation of feelings afterwards. And I will just read it out. So now you're just going to have to listen, because you haven't got it there, I believe. It is there. Okay. Good. So it is there. So you have it. Good. So in that case, we should definitely do it. Yeah. Again, bhikkhus, a bhikkhu reviews this very body, however it is placed, however disposed, by way of elements. Thus, in this body there are the earth element, the water element, the fire element, and the air element. Just as though a skilled butcher or his apprentice had killed a cow and was seated at the crossroads with it cut up into pieces, so too a bhikkhu reviews this very body, however it is placed, however disposed, by way of elements. Thus, in this body there are the earth element, the water element, the fire element, and the air element. So there you are. So that is the five element contemplation. And then you do the same as before. You do it internally, externally, and both internally and externally. So this is a nice way of gaining a very kind of neutral feeling about the body, right? It's not as if you find that the other aspect is a bit repulsive to see all the parts of the body. This is a very neutral way of looking at the body. The body has solid elements in it. It obviously has water elements to it, air and heat. These are the four aspects you can quite easily see in the physical body. And one way that this contemplation is explained, this is in the suttas, and if you're interested in this particular sutta, it's the Majjhima Nikaya number 28. It's called the greatest sutta on the simile of the elephant's footprint, the Mahahati Padopama Sutta, Majjhima 28. And this explained in great detail there how to do the element contemplation. But you don't have to make it very complicated. It's just the understanding that the body is made of these four things, right? And you can see these aspects in you. And where do all these elements come from? Well, ultimately, they come from the outside, right? You eat things, and then because you eat things, when you're small, you grow and you become, you know, you. So all of these things are basically built up of the stuff you eat. And as it says elsewhere in the Sutta, there's a body which is built up out of rice and porridge. That's quite literally what it says, right? Okay, these days, out of cornflakes and potatoes or whatever, right? So, but this is what it's built, this is what the body is built up of, right? It's built up of all these things that we take from the outside. Ultimately, it's just the soil, right? The soil goes into the corn, and then you eat the corn. And so it's all the same stuff. The external world and the internal world is the same. This is where we come from. So we have arisen from the earth and the water outside. And then when you die, everything goes back to that again, right? You get buried, the body decomposes, and eventually it just spreads out, and eventually goes into another plant, and then it gets recycled into another person. So this is, so when you see it like that, you realize that this, what you are now, is really no different from the external elements. It's all part and parcel of the same thing. And that's why, of course, you can't control it. Right? There's no control over these things. Eventually, the body will go back into those elements again. It is those elements right now, and eventually it will go back. It is just nature taking its course. It's just the elements taking different shapes. Right now, these elements have the shape of your body. That shape will change and will go back again into the more natural shape, or the same natural shape as it had before you became, as this body was created. And this way, it is recycled, going round and round, taking different shapes, right? That's really all it is. And it's the four elements. And when you see your body in that way again, you can get a kind of dispassion towards it. You don't actually hold on so much anymore. And it's easy to let go of this. It's just the same as letting go of the earth element outside. How difficult is it to let go of that? It's very easy, because the earth outside has got nothing to do with you, right? So you don't have to worry about that. You don't have to try very hard to get, you know, to kind of abandon the trees outside or whatever before you go into meditation. It's very, very simple, because it's nothing to do with you. The same thing with your body. It is no different from that. So again, very useful. Don't make it too complicated. Just simple like that. And then when you think about that, again, it gives rise to a sense of less attachment to the body. So this is what all of this is about. Again, internally and externally, about yourself, and then other people, and eventually universalized. Everybody is the same. It's all the same. It's just material phenomena changing form from one thing to another, again and again, round and around it goes. Okay, so that is the contemplation of the body. The next one here is a charnel ground contemplation, which I have taken out, and these are quite literally contemplation of the corpses in various stages of decay here. And again, it's this, you know, is it one of those things that if you, you know, you use, again, if you have to get rid of some of the any remaining attachment you have to the body here. And after you do all of this, after you go through the attachment is reduced to the body, then the next contemplation that we come to is the contemplation of feeling here. So that is, so this is called Vedana Nupassana in the Pali language. And it is here an observation of an aspect of the feelings, right? One aspect at a time is what this is about. So let's have a look at what this is all about. And how, bhikkhus, does a bhikkhu abide contemplating an aspect of feelings? Here, when feeling a pleasant feeling, a bhikkhu understands, I feel a pleasant feeling. When feeling a painful feeling, he understands, I feel a painful feeling. When feeling a neither painful nor pleasant feeling, he understands, I feel a neither painful nor pleasant feeling. When feeling a worldly pleasant feeling, he understands, I feel a worldly pleasant feeling. When feeling an unworldly pleasant feeling, he understands, I feel an unworldly pleasant feeling here. When feeling a worldly painful feeling, he understands, I feel a worldly painful feeling. When feeling an unworldly painful feeling, he understands, I feel an unworldly painful feeling. when feeling a worldly, neither painful nor pleasant feeling, he understands, I feel a worldly, neither painful nor pleasant feeling. And when feeling an unworldly, neither painful nor pleasant feeling, he understands, I feel an unworldly, neither painful nor pleasant feeling. Very, very repetitive little passage. But the main aspects here is, first of all, to distinguish between painful feeling, pleasant feeling, and neutral feeling, right? This is the basic thing here. And so this, again, these things have various degrees, right? Painful feeling, pleasant feelings, and neutral feelings have different degrees to them. So here what we're doing is kind of getting to the full understanding of these things. And as you gain the full understanding of these things, you start to, you start to be able to reject those things that are not really, in the end, you understand that they are painful and you let go of that. And eventually you understand that actually the highest kind of pleasure is this neither pleasant nor pain. It's a strange thing, right? That the highest pleasure should be neither painful nor pleasant. Instead of pleasure being the highest pleasure, it is neither pleasure nor pain which is the highest pleasure. This is one of the strange things about this path. The higher up you move, the more you abandon, the more equanimous the mind is, the more neutral it is, the more pleasure it is, in a non-pleasurable sense. Right? It's hard to get your mind around this. So this is why we contemplate these feelings, to understand the process, what is going on. And the next part here, it has this important distinction between worldly and unworldly feelings. Worldly feelings are in the Pali called samisa sukha. And amisa quite literally means flesh or meat, right? So flesh is the fleshly feelings. In English, we have actually a very good word for it. It's the carnal, basically the carnal feelings, right? The word carnal is kind of one of those Christian words, basically to do with the physical body. So these are the carnal feelings, the feelings that have to do with the five senses, to do with the body. These are what is here, I call the worldly feelings. And then you have the unworldly feelings, and the unworldly feelings are the feelings when you go beyond the body, right? So here you can already start, this is called niramisa in Pali, and without flesh, right? Beyond flesh, niramisa. Ni is like a negation. And so these are the feelings that you get when you abandon the body, when you abandon the five senses. So these have to do with the states of samadhi. And here you can see already, here at this stage already, we are moving the bar fairly high way, going away already from the ordinary world of the five senses and moving into the samadhi states. And here you can see how samadhi itself is an aspect of satipatthana. Niramisa sukha, quite literally elsewhere, is defined as the four jhanas. So part of the contemplation in the Satipatthana Sutta itself is actually the contemplation of the four jhanas. This forms part, an aspect of this. And this is what makes the Satipatthana Sutta a little bit different from how Satipatthana is normally explained. Because normally it is the pathway to jhanas, but here it actually includes them, and specifically includes the contemplation of these states of samadhi. So here already we're getting towards very profound things. But the most important thing here is to understand the distinction between these feelings. And when you meditate and you start to feel, right, some kind of piti, you feel the rapture, or you feel some degree of gladness arising in your mind as a consequence of you becoming very peaceful, the breath is becoming delightful, right? Or you're just contemplating some happy incident in the past when you did something that was good. That pleasure that comes with that is an aspect of niramisa sukha, of the unworldly happiness. You're already starting to tap into that at that point, right? So many of you are feeling some happiness in your meditation. I know that because you tell me that. That's great. And what that means is that you're already starting to feel the unworldly happiness. At this point, it's still a little bit mixed because your body is still there, the senses are still present. So it's a mixed kind of feeling. It's not pure yet, but you're heading in the right direction. And the pure niramisa sukha, the pure unworldly sukha, happens only when you abandon the body absolutely. So this stage is a bit mixed, but you're getting, starting to tap into those feelings, right? You start to get and understand what it means to be unworldly here. So this is what the unworldliness is all about. So you are literally moving out of this world into something else. So that is the unworldly, the worldly happiness and the unworldly happiness. And of course, once you start to compare these things, you start to understand why this unworldly happiness is so much more powerful than the worldly happiness. There's no craving involved. There's no desire. It's an immediate happiness you have here and now. It is very beautiful. And it becomes more stronger and stronger and stronger, more and more powerful, right? This is kind of the amazing thing with this. You're moving towards more and more powerful, happy states. And you kind of, wow, it kind of blows your mind after a while. You wonder, where is this going to end, you know? And as Ajahn Ram says, there comes a point when you think to yourself, I can't take any more happiness. I just can't, you know, it's just too much. I don't know how to deal with this. And this is sort of the way it is heading here. And that is kind of a very nice message, isn't it? You can get so much happiness, you don't even know how to deal with all the happiness. It's kind of very... very beautiful, beautiful thing. But of course, after a while, you learn how to deal with it. And then you go even further and further. This remarkable Buddhist path. So that is, and then you understand the difference between these things by direct, immediate experience, right? The understanding of these things. You also start, you be able to compare and you start to understand what this path is all about. And then you have the unworldly and the worldly unpleasant feeling here. And you might wonder what the unworldly, unpleasant feeling might be like. You know, if you are kind of abandoning the body and the five senses, what is unworldly, unpleasant feeling here? And what that is, according to the suttas, unworldly, unpleasant feeling is when you think to yourself, you can sort of see all the problems in the world, and you think to yourself, oh, when am I going to attain nibbana? When am I going to get there? And you have this yearning, this kind of... yearning to kind of make an end of all this nonsense and all this suffering in the world. That is the unworldly, unpleasant feeling. When you want to just get rid of all the problems in the world and you want to move forward, but you haven't got there yet, and you can see the problem, you can see the solution, but you still have a way to go before you get there. And that is compared to the unworldly, to the worldly unpleasant feeling. And the worldly unpleasant feeling is all the suffering of life that everyone is exposed to. And then lastly, you have the worldly and unworldly, neither painful nor pleasant feeling. And here, the worldly part of this is just kind of the neutral feeling, which is kind of, you know, almost like boredom or kind of, you're not really interested in things, right? It's just like you had a good meal and then food doesn't look interesting anymore, right? You had a good meal and food sort of puts you a little bit off, you're not interested in that. It's not because you have understood what's going on. It's not because you never will be attracted to food again. It's just almost like a kind of slightly deluded feeling. Okay, you're just not interested. Whereas the unworldly, neither pleasant nor painful feeling is actually when you go beyond all pleasure and pain and you understand that neither pleasant nor painful feeling is one of the highest states you can actually attain in samsara, in this world of rebirth. That's what you understand. And again, it's very difficult to understand this. This is what the Buddha says, this is how the path works. So sometimes you think, okay, if the Buddha says so, there must be something, there's probably something to this. Let me see what happens as I move along. And as you move in that direction, you start to get a feeling for why this must be the case. So this is the contemplation of feelings. And one of the problems here is, well, exactly how do you contemplate these things, right? Okay, you experience these things, but as you can see, many of these feelings are related to meditation practice itself. And of course, this is one of the things that we will see, I'm not sure when, this afternoon or tomorrow or something, when we go into the Anapanasati Sutta, you will see that the way that these things arise and the way you contemplate this, the way it is explained in the Anapanasati Sutta is you do it by mindfulness of breathing here. So Satipatthana and mindfulness of breathing are one and the same thing here. When you do Anapanasati, you are doing Satipatthana. And this is how you experience those feelings, through the mindfulness of the breath. It makes things very simple. You don't have to be too worried. Well, how do I experience these things? Well, just by watching the breath. That's how you experience these things here. Okay, And then we have the same passage again about internal, external, and both internal and external. So internally is, of course, about yourself, and it always is about yourself, first of all. You see all these feelings in yourself, and you understand that, then you have an immediate understanding of these things. And then what you do is that you also do it externally about other people. You know that if it happens to you, the same thing is true also for others. And then eventually you universalize and you understand that this is true for everybody. And what that means, once you universalize, you understand that there is no, it's not, the problem isn't with you, right? This is the nature of things. It doesn't matter where you get reborn. It doesn't matter what kind of being you are. It doesn't matter what realm you go to. It is a universal experience for all beings. This is how feelings, how they change and how they move around and how they take different shapes. It is always true. And so you understand that you cannot actually escape this as long as you are part of this rebirth process of samsara. That is what this universalization does. You understand this is a universal truth that is always true regardless of what happens in this course of rebirth. True for all beings. Okay. So that is the feelings. And remember here, we are moving up, right? You're abandoning the body more and more, and you're starting to experience the unworldly feelings, the niramisa, the uncarnal feelings, perhaps. And now the next contemplation is a contemplation of mind. And that is what's coming up now. And even more refined. Now we're going into the world of the mind. And how, bhikkhus, does a bhikkhu abide contemplating, and mind here, I would say, an aspect of the mind again? How does it go about contemplating or observing an aspect of the mind? Here a bhikkhu understands the mind affected by desire. It says lust here, but desire is a bit more broad and probably a bit more appropriate. Affected by desire as a mind affected by desire. A mind unaffected by desire as a mind unaffected by desire. He understands a mind affected by hate or by ill will as a mind affected by ill will, and a mind unaffected by ill will as a mind unaffected by ill will. He understands a mind affected by delusion as a mind affected by delusion, or confusion if you like, and a mind unaffected by confusion as a mind unaffected by confusion. He understands a contracted mind as a contracted mind, and a distracted mind as a distracted mind. He understands an exalted mind as exalted mind, an unexalted mind as unexalted mind. He understands the surpassed mind as a surpassed mind, the unsurpassed mind as the unsurpassed mind. He understands the concentrated mind as concentrated, and the unconcentrated mind as unconcentrated. He understands the liberated mind as liberated, and the unliberated mind as unliberated. And here you see a similar kind of progression that we have just seen with feelings. The progression of moving from all the defiled mind states to the very, very pure mind states at the end. The same kind of thing. And all of these exercises are about purifying ourselves, right? Understanding the defilements, understanding the problems, and moving towards more refined states of mind. This is what this is all about. And that's why all of these exercises are about, or all of these contemplations are about understanding defilements and understanding the purity that comes when the defilements are abandoned. And in this particular case, there is an emphasis on the five hindrances. The five hindrances are very prominent here, because you have the mind with lust. Raga is the Pali word. It basically means any kind of desire relating to the five senses. So you understand what that is, right? And again, remember, you understand this completely in its full range of different ways that it happens, different intensities that it happens through the different senses and all these kind of things. You understand it in its full range. And that is why understanding is actually more profound than you think it might be. Sometimes it's very obvious that there is a craving or desire there. Sometimes it is not so obvious because it's very subtle. So you understand the mind with desire, you understand what it means to be without this, right? You have the comparison here. And when you can compare, you know where what you should be doing, where you should be heading here. And the same thing with ill will, right? You understand it in its full nature, all aspects of ill will, even to the most refined kind of things that you are kind of averse towards or whatever it is. And then you know the mind that is completely free from that. The mind where the metta, the loving kindness is easy, where the friendliness is easy, right? It just happens by itself. The opposite of the mind of ill will. And delusion, moha, can perhaps often be translated as confusion. It's the mind which has, you know, all these other things that are not directly related to ill will or a desire, but you know the mind is doesn't really understand. You don't feel clear about things. You feel a bit restless. You feel a bit dull. You feel a sense of unclarity. Doubt is an important part of this as well. And again, you understand the distinction between that confusion and doubt, and when the mind is free from that. And then we have the next ones here are the mind which is contracted, and this is just the Pali word for the mind which is slothful, right? When you have a sense of sloth, it's like the mind, you can't really, it uses a simile in the suttas, the sloth or the tiredness or the lethargy, it's like being in prison, it says, right? You're imprisoned, you can't get out, you're kind of enclosed inside of yourself, and this sloth is kind of overgrowing you, and you are trapped inside this, just like you are a prisoner. And you understand that, what that means, and you understand the escape from that, and you understand the distracted mind is the next one. This is the opposite. This is like being a slave, according to the simile found elsewhere. You're restless, right? You are being driven to do things. There's something inside you which causes you to do things. Restlessness is like you can't be peaceful. And you are a slave to that restlessness, quite literally. And then, so these are, you can see how these are roughly equivalent to the five hindrances. That's roughly what you have here. But it's termed in slightly different ways. And this is one of the things that I think the Buddha does on purpose. He shows things from different angles, different ways of looking at it, so that you get a more complete understanding of what something is. So this is looking at the hindrances from different angles, and hopefully that will improve your understanding of these matters. And then you come to, then we're moving on to the states of mind, which are the opposite of when the hindrances have disappeared. And you have the, it says here, you have the exalted mind, right? Mahagata, literally gone great. Maha means great. Gata means gone. So it's the mind gone great, quite literally. And that is a word. Mahagata is a word that is often used. It is always used in conjunction with the Brahma Viharas, with the divine abidings, with metta, you know, metta, karuna, compassion, loving kindness, etc. So the mind has gone great. It has expanded. You have taken away the limits. The hindrances are limitations on the mind that make it small. And then take these away. You can feel, when the less hindrances you have, it almost feels like you are expanding your mind, right? It's like you feel kind of, you feel the sense of expansion happening here. And this is what this is. What this means is that you are moving towards the Mahagata Chitta, the exalted mind. These are the beautiful states of mind. So you know what that means, right? And again, once you know these things, knowing here means direct experience. That's really what it means. Once you know through direct experience, then you start to understand what suffering is and what happiness is in this world, because you have an ability to compare what is going on. So this is the Mahagata mind, the exalted mind, the surpassed mind, or unsurpassed mind, Anuttara. And Anuttara is usually a very lofty term in the suttas. And again, it refers to something similar. It is not clear. It may not have a very precise reference here. It may not mean anything very specific, but it means things like the jhanas, right? It means states where you're reaching the peak of something. So, for example, the peak of piti, the peak of rapture, would be in the second jhana. The peak of happiness is in the third jhana. The peak of all material phenomena is in the fourth jhana, etc., etc. There's different types of peaks, different types of anuttara chittas. And then there are the stages of becoming an arya, right? These are also anuttaras in a certain way. But here it probably refers to samadhi rather than direct insight, because that's where we're heading in a sense. And then you have the concentrated mind or the stilled mind, right? Again, you can see how all of this is about samadhi. Samadhi is what we're talking about now. And the liberated mind is the last one, and the unliberated mind. This is vimutta citta. And the vimutta, what are you liberated from? And what you're liberated from mainly is the hindrances, it's the body, it's the five senses, the things that limit the mind, the things that, once you go beyond this, only then do you fully understand that you have been liberated from something oppressive. You were oppressed before, you can't really see it because you're always living in this oppression. But when you release that liberation, you see, wow, that was oppression before. It's like the fish in water, right? Fish in water doesn't know what water is. Or the tadpole, if you like. Once you become a frog, then you see. And it's the same kind of idea here. Once you are fully removed, then you feel liberation. No more hindrances. No more body. No more sensory impact. None of all that stuff. Wow. It is freedom that you are understanding at this point. So all of this is, all of these contemplations are about understanding the mind, understanding feelings, understanding our experience, basically. That's what it comes down to. Understanding our experience in terms of lower phenomena and higher phenomena, and understanding what is suffering and what is happiness, and then how we move from one to the other. And again, it's exactly the same thing with the mind as with everything else. You start off internally looking at yourself. Then you know that this is also true for other people, and then you universalize. This is true for all beings. There is no escape from these mind states. As long as you are in samsara, you're going to be trapped in this, within this realm of mind state, just like everybody else. And you will move up and down. There's no such thing as a rebirth or a state of being which kind of escapes from the bad and you can only have the good, for example. And this is how you universalize that understanding. And then after a while, you start to realize that, you know, you have to actually get rid of all of this stuff and move beyond these things. So that is the contemplation of mind. And I'm going to stop there. But just to give you a quick preview, the last contemplation of the Satipatthana is the contemplation of mind objects. And that is where we start to look at the idea of conditionality. So far, it's just the understanding of things. But of course, an important aspect is how the whole thing works, right? Why do certain things arise? And this is what we will look at this afternoon. So we will see you then.